and I'm very hopeful that they continue that process.
There's a highlight from a recent episode of The Breach Show. Find new episodes at breachmedia.ca, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You listen to Harbinger Showcase in your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Since launching in October 2022, Sources has provided in-depth interviews with experts and newsmakers across the country from the award-winning journalists at Press Progress. On this excerpt from a new episode, Canadian Doctors for Medicare's Danielle Raza talks about why the public healthcare system is a Canadian social expression of care and should be a nation-building priority. Now, here's a highlight from that conversation.
So many of us think about our healthcare system as part of what makes us Canadian, as I would argue, I think, one of the highest expressions of us caring for one another. And I can think of nothing more worthy of nation building than that. And I would love it if the Prime Minister shared that point of view. But I am struggling to see that right now.
You're listening to Sources. I'm your host, Eric Wickham. Not even a decade ago, if you asked a Canadian to name something they appreciated about their country, invariably its single-payer healthcare system would be brought up. However, creeping privatization, chronic underfunding, and personnel shortages have taken their toll on this former point of national pride. Dr. Danielle Raza, a family doctor at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto, an assistant professor with the University of Toronto, and a Broadbent Institute research fellow, says Canada's public healthcare system should be a nation-building priority. Earlier this month, at the 2026 Progress Summit in Ottawa, our health reporter Brishti Basu caught up with Dr. Raza to talk about the state of Canadian healthcare and what can be done to ensure our neighbors and loved ones are getting equitable access to care.
Hi, Dr. Danielle Raza. Thanks for joining us on Sources today.
Happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about what you do. What's your role right now?
I'm a family doctor in Toronto. I'm also an assistant professor at the University of Toronto. I'm a board director at Canadian Doctors for Medicare, and I'm a Broadbent Institute policy fellow.
In your time at this conference, at the summit this week, you've had to step away for a period of time. Tell me about the press conference that you were at yesterday.
Yeah, yesterday morning, we hosted a press conference on the Hill. And by we, I mean Canadian Doctors for Medicare in collaboration with the Canadian Health Coalition and the Canadian Medical Association, calling on the federal government, the Prime Minister, and the Minister of Health to act on Bill 11, which is legislation that was passed in Alberta that will essentially allow two-tier healthcare or dual practice for physicians. And we're asking for the federal government to enforce the Canada Health Act to make sure that Daniel Smith's plan for essentially privatized healthcare doesn't go through.
And how did that go? What kind of responses did you receive from the federal government and Alberta?
So the press conference actually followed a letter that we sent to the Prime Minister and the Minister of Health. It was signed by 23 major health and labor organizations. So we've had, including the press conference, two explicit reach outs to the minister and to the Prime Minister. We haven't heard back yet, but the letter and the presser did pick up some media coverage, including in places like the CBC and CTV. And in fact, the question about our concerns with Bill 11 was put to Danielle Smith, and she was forced to respond.
We're anticipating that this will reduce waiting lists and provide better care. So we just have a fundamental difference of opinion. I believe that the legislation to enable it will be coming in this session.
No surprise she, you know, disagreed with the fact that her own legislation is harmful, but it at least has got her attention, and I'm sure has got the attention of the federal minister of health. So now we're waiting to see if they're going to move forward and actually do something about this.
Why is Bill 11 such a threat to public health care in Canada?
So the challenge with introducing a dual practice system is that we don't have a unlimited supply of healthcare workers. Every country, every jurisdiction only has so many doctors or nurses. So when you introduce a private pay system, you drain and you divert scarce doctors, scarce nurses, and other healthcare workers away from the public system to folks who can pay their way to the front of the line ahead of other people in Canada who frankly need more urgent care. So there are fewer healthcare workers left in the public system that most of us depend on to take care of everyone. It's a really cruel and I think regressive way to allocate healthcare workers. Anyone who's ever heard the term social determinants of health knows that the communities that have the highest health needs are the lowest income, and those who tend to be the healthiest are also the wealthiest. But when you introduce a dual practice, you're putting resources not where they're most needed, right? And the folks who are the wealthiest who tend to be the healthiest also are get prioritized for care. And, you know, this is not just a theoretical concern. We've seen wait lists get longer in places that have instituted dual practice, including places in, like Australia, the UK, and Ireland. And in fact, at the Scambi Surgical trial, which was a major legal challenge in British Columbia to Medicare, we had legal experts and healthcare experts come from these countries and warn the courts, saying that if Canada, whether it's through legal means or legislative means, moves to a two-tier healthcare system, then Canadians will suffer.
What was the Canby trial about? Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so before there was Bill 11 in Alberta, which is an explicitly legislative attempt to introduce private pay healthcare, there was the Canby Surgeries trial in British Columbia that was heard at the BC Supreme Court. It concluded in 2020, and it was brought forward by an orthopedic surgeon who owns and runs a private-for-profit surgical center, who was attempting to make the argument that by not allowing doctors to bill patients for medically necessary care, their charter rights were being violated. You know, this trial concluded in 2020, but it took 10 years to get there. It involved lots of parties. You know, there was the Attorney General of BC, who were the defendants in the case, but there were also third parties, including Canadian Doctors for Medicare. We were there as interveners. So was the Attorney General of Canada. And when the judge finally did issue his ruling, it was more than 200 pages, and it was a definitive dismissal of the plaintiff's case. And not only that, but folks listening, if you go to the Canadian Doctors for Medicare website, we have a summary of the case and parts of the case that really highlight the international evidence and underpin the judge's decision. The judgment was so comprehensive that the plaintiffs lost at the appeals court in BC. And then when they attempted to take the case to the Supreme Court of Canada, the Supreme Court of Canada didn't even entertain the case in court.
We know that there are aspects of Canadian healthcare right now that are already privatized. And, you know, in addition, there's more and more doctors moving to platforms like telehealth. Yeah. What kinds of impacts have we seen of, say, like diagnostics and telehealth?
I think that we, and I mean we broadly, including our political leaders, have been pretty inattentive to the public healthcare system. When you look at every dollar that's spent on healthcare in Canada, 70 cents or 70% is public and 30 cents or 30% is private. But what does that mean, right? When you compare Canada to other countries, and let's put the U.S. to the side, you know, we're not looking to the U.S. anymore. We're turning more and more to Europeans. So let's look at the Europeans. Countries like the Netherlands, France, Germany, the U.K., the Nordic countries, they all spend 80% or more of every dollar from public sources on their healthcare system compared to us, 70%. Not only that, but when you look at the last 5 years of data and you look at the growth of spending on healthcare, both public and private, private spending has outpaced public spending for four of the past 5 years. And I bring this up because the narrative that we often hear is that healthcare spending in Canada is out of control and we can't afford any more public investments. But if you have to actually look at the numbers, it's actually private healthcare spending that is out of control, and we're underinvesting, at least if we are comparing ourselves to Europe and not the United States, we're underinvesting in our public healthcare system. So we need to change the narrative and the way that we're talking about care. And the reason I bring this up in response to the question about the rise of things like virtual care, in particular private pay virtual care or other sorts of private pay services that are coming up, is that the inattention to the public healthcare system means that I think our shared sense of purpose and our social solidarity is, it's not frayed, but it's starting to fray. And so folks who can or will pay to jump the line, even if it comes at the expense of everyone else, will do so. And there will be investors who will give them opportunities to do that. And I would argue it's actually fine for them to pay more for care. But we have two choices. We can allow the status quo to continue and allow folks to jump the line at the expense of others. Or we can have an adult conversation about increasing funding for the public healthcare system and having the wealthy pay more through things like robust progressive taxation. You know, the money for the healthcare system has to come from somewhere, and I'm not afraid, and we shouldn't be afraid of having that conversation. And that includes progressive taxation to support the sort of system that I think we all know we need.
Earlier in this conversation, you touched on like social determinants of health. This whole conversation about privatization is the divide between haves and have-nots. There's another divide that already exists between rural and urban communities and access to care for rural and particularly Indigenous communities in Canada. In your primary care philosophy, what are the solutions that you envision for that?
People living in rural Canada have some of the largest challenges to accessing care and accessing services. There are almost 6 million people in our country who don't have access to a family doctor or a nurse practitioner, and nowhere is this a larger problem than in rural Canada. So I think a big part of the solution to rural healthcare is really doubling down on primary care, and not the old way of doing primary care where, you know, the doctor could open an office with a secretary and provide pretty good care. That made sense 30 years ago, but, you know, medicine and health is way more complex. We do so much more chronic disease management. That model of taking care of people, it doesn't do the job anymore. We really need to invest. It's not just about new money, but it's about investing new money in more creative ways and, frankly, best practices. And in primary care, that's team-based care. That means that when a patient shows up for their appointment, yes, of course, they'll have a doctor there to quarterback their care, but they'll have access in that same building or in that same community to a social worker if they need it, to a dietitian, to a physiotherapist, and it's all publicly covered. So that's somewhere we need everywhere in the country, but I think we need it in rural Canada more, really, than anywhere else.
So kind of like the community health clinic model.
Exactly. And that's the good news, is we have actually a model of care everywhere in this country where that's already happening. Community health centers are a great example. And then we also have, for example, Ontario, we have family health teams, which are another model. But even in Ontario, where I practice, only 20% of people in the province have access to team-based care, whether it's a family health team or a community health center. I think both are great ways to do this sorts of care. Every province, every community, I think, will have maybe better served by one model or the other. But the point is that we need more of both.
The fundamental problem of just Canada not having enough doctors, I suppose we're addressing that now by courting doctors from the U.S. that are trying to get out of the U.S. because of that administration and RFK Jr.'s brain rooms. But that, and then in addition to that, there's, you know, med schools being built across Canada. I think there's 6 new ones. So is that promising as a way to address the shortage, do you think?
I'm a doctor. I love being a doctor. I love being a doctor who takes care of patients. But it's also very obvious to me and my colleagues that just training more doctors is not going to fix the problem. And that recruiting doctors from other countries is also, it will help, but it's also not going to fix the problem. And frankly, I don't want to fix the problem in Canada at the expense of people who need healthcare otherwise, whether it's in the United States or whether it's in, you know, low and middle income countries that have far greater healthcare needs than we do. We face serious challenges, but so do other folks. And I don't want to fix healthcare in Canada on the backs of other folks who are also struggling. So we really need a made in Canada solution. And I think the way that we do that is we recognize, again, that healthcare is best delivered not by a single person, but by a team. Healthcare has evolved and changed a lot over the past 40 years since the Canada Health Act was passed. I am not the only person who is capable of looking after a patient. I work as part of a team so that if a patient comes and sees me and they have questions about how their medications interact with one another, I could talk to them about it. But I also have an amazing pharmacist whose office is right across the hall from me. It makes a lot of sense for the patient to talk with our team pharmacist. If a patient comes in, they're going through a tough time, there's a diagnosis of depression, I will talk, I will spend time with them, I will prescribe medication if it makes sense. But hey, three doors down, we have our social work team. Probably makes sense that they meet with them as well. And I think that is how every single doctor that we have can take care of even more patients, and patients can be matched with the most appropriate person to take care of their needs.
That was an excerpt from a recent episode of Press Progress Sources. Find out more at pressprogress.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. And finally, releasing bi-weekly in spring 2026, Student Power, a Canadian student movement history podcast, presents a history of on-campus activism and the Canadian student movement with Dr. Roberta Lexier in Calgary. On highlight from this week's episode, Dr. Lexier examines the repression of pro-Palestine encampments at University of Calgary and University of Alberta in a conversation with independent Edmonton-based journalist Jeremy Appel. Now, here's the show.
Hello, you're listening to Student Power, Canadian student movements from the 60s to today. I'm Dr. Roberta Lexier. I've been studying student movements in Canada for more than 25 years, which means that one, I'm very old, and two, I'm an expert in their history. In fact, I literally wrote the book on the topic, published by Palgrave Macmillan in January 2026. It is like this podcast series called Student Power, Canadian student movements from the 60s to today. You can find the link in the show notes. This six-part podcast series, loosely based on the book, examines key moments of upheaval on Canadian university campuses over the past 75 years and answers a seemingly simple yet ultimately complex question. Why did authorities, university administrators, law enforcement, and the judicial system respond so forcefully, so uncharacteristically to the spring 2024 pro-Palestinian encampments protesting institutional complicity in the ongoing genocide in Gaza? Student Power is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network, so-called Canada's progressive podcast community. Find more than 80 leftist Canadian podcasts at harbingermedianetwork.com. This podcast is recorded in Treaty 7 on land stolen from its original inhabitants, to whom I'm eternally grateful and pledge to do my best to fulfill my obligations as a treaty person. Thank you to the Niitsitapi, the Yahe Nakoda, the Tsuut'ina Nations, Métis Nation Districts 5 and 6, and the others who allow me to live, learn, and thrive in this place. Now let's get to it. This episode takes us back to where we began, the spring 2024 pro-Palestinian encampments and the speedy, violent response from university administrators to dissent on campus. My question from the beginning has been, was this specific to the Palestinian protests, the Palestinian exception, or is it somehow connected to broader changes associated with the shift to neoliberalism or other factors? Stay tuned for the next and final episode for more on this question. But for now, we need to better understand what actually happened in the spring of 2024 at Canadian universities. It's, of course, important to keep in mind the context within which these encampments emerged. First of all, there's the genocide happening in Gaza and elsewhere in the Palestinian territories. And since October 7th, 2023, Israel has doubled down on its efforts to eliminate the Palestinian peoples from the territory. And Western powers, institutions, organizations, and others were clearly complicit in this genocide. Now, it's important, of course, to keep in mind that what students faced on their campuses in Canada and elsewhere around the world in the spring of 2024 is nothing compared to what the Palestinians are facing, direct attacks and genocide. And so it's important to keep in mind what the purpose of these protests were and to keep some perspective on what happened on the ground in Canada. This is also a period of extreme neoliberalism and ongoing economic crises. This had been ongoing since the early 2000s and had continued to increase economic inequality, in particular across the West, but also between the global North and the global South. Unsurprisingly, as a result of these economic difficulties, we've also seen rising fascism as the capitalist system and its players try to deflect from the crisis of capitalism and blame others for the problems. And so across the globe, we've seen fascism on the the rise. We've also seen the increasing evidence of the climate catastrophe with rising sea levels and storms and droughts. Massive waves of refugees are starting to appear, and we're obviously facing the repercussions of an unaddressed climate emergency. There was also and is also the COVID-19 pandemic that really laid bare the death wish of modern day capitalism, that it's willing to sacrifice its workers for profit. And the fact that we have yet to address the pandemic is, I think, real evidence of this issue. And continuing from the previous period we talked about last episode, universities continued to face similar attacks. The right-wing ideological opposition framed around so-called free speech, increasing privatization and austerity, corporatization, and the focus on market forces. So expensive, job-oriented, corporate-modeled and run institutions are now the norm. And in fact, we've even seen universities go into financial catastrophe. The message that we are taught is that change is not possible, that neoliberalism and capitalism are the only options, and that disruption is not tolerated by the system. In the spring of 2024, as classes were nearing their end for the term, students around the world launched massive protests against Israel's ongoing military assaults on Gaza, widely recognized as a genocide against the Palestinian people. Drawing on the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, or BDS movement, which had been established by Palestinian civil society organizations in 2005 as a nonviolent strategy to economically and politically isolate Israel and force the end of the illegal occupation and the apartheid regime, activists established on-campus encampments to escalate pressure on administrations to divest from Israel. The response was swift. At the University of Toronto, administrators appealed for an injunction to end what they characterized as a violent anti-Semitic protest that interfered with essential institutional operations on their so-called private property. A judge ultimately dismissed claims of violence and anti-Semitism, but did grant the injunction based on property rights. And before police could force them out, protesters agreed to end their encampment after 2 months. As a scholar of student movements, this was a surprising turn of events. Universities and courts have historically allowed protests, even encampments, on what was previously considered public property, protected by the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. But it paled in comparison to the sudden, brutal response in Alberta, where at the University of Calgary and University of Alberta, police were asked to clear the encampments before it could even last the night in the first case, and did so using advanced crowd control techniques like batons, tear gas, and pepper bullets. I spoke with Edmonton-based journalist Jeremy Appel in October 2025 about the Alberta encampments and what he found through an extensive Freedom of Information request about the decisions that led to their violent dismantling. Let's just start with the encampments in Alberta. How did they emerge?
Thanks to the University of Alberta's sort of third-party investigation into the encampment, the province was talking to the presidents of all the universities in March, before the encampments went out in May, telling them, hey, if this happens here, because they saw them going up in the States, right, and elsewhere, they're like, if you need any support, just let us know. So from the outset, the government took the approach, administrators, especially at University of Calgary, before even the first tent was pitched, that this isn't going to happen. This isn't allowed. This is anti-Semitic. It makes Jews unsafe, even though, as you know, I'm sure listeners know, many of the leading participants in these encampments were Jewish. They were, you know, having Shabbat dinners, which, you know, real anti-Semitic of them. The UCP government has been, loudly screaming about threats to academic freedom coming from the left. And under former Premier Jason Kenney, all the universities had signed these free speech codes to enshrine the Chicago principles, which talk about how just because speech makes you feel uncomfortable doesn't mean it makes you unsafe. And then when it comes to left-wing speech, it's just like, no, this makes people unsafe, and we need to use the force of the law to suppress it. So it was very much a domino effect.
So before we get into the why this happened, can you tell me about how these encampments were dismantled? What actually kind of happens on the ground first in Calgary and then in Edmonton?
It seemed that University of Alberta was taking a more ambivalent approach to the encampment, more wait and see, whereas University of Calgary, right from the outset, from before the encampment went up, saying that, all right, we've created this policy that's actually not a new policy. This is just reiterating existing policy, saying that there are no temporary structures allowed on campus. Now, if you go to the existing policies that they said, it clarifies none of them mention anything about temporary structures being prohibited. And they have lists of activities that are prohibited. And it does say that, you know, administration can prohibit certain activities, but none of the things listed say temporary structures. So this was invented specifically to prevent the encampments from going up. As soon as the encampment did go up, you know, at the crack of dawn on May 9th, the university called the cops to campus, and the cops started setting up this sort of temporary police station at McMahon Stadium on campus. And then throughout the day, they're telling the students and faculty and other community members who are gathered there that they can't be here, that they're trespassing, that this is illegal. And then by night, members of the community were, you know, negotiating with the police to be like, okay, well, we take down the tents. Can we stay? Multiple people who were involved told me they had already agreed to take down the tents. And then the cops decided your time's up. They, you know, in this really eerie scene, you know, they march towards the students with their shields in unison, chanting "Move." And in that process, I know one student in particular got hit in the head.
Highlight from a recent episode of Student Power. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's community of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unrigged.ca. And by the Alberta Advantage. Find the show's almost 9 years of archived episodes at albertaadvantagepod.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Blue Sky and Instagram for updates on new episodes and events, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 89 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Is Bird Note. Poet Sidney Wade has been birding for nearly 20 years. But for even the most experienced birders, there are days when we learn something entirely unexpected. Here's Sydney with a poem about one such encounter with a double-crested cormorant.
Blue. The great blue song of the earth is sung in all the best venues, treetop, marsh, desert, shore. And on this spring day in the wetlands where, under a late sun, we stand alone and in love with each other and the passing day, we watch a cormorant whose eye is ringed in blue diamonds, a shimmering lure, and we love this blue and this dark bird and this deepening sky that pinks and hums in the west. And then the bird opens his beak and flutters his throat, and the late afternoon light illuminates the inside tissue of his mouth, which is as blue as his ocular jewelry, as blue as the bluest ocean, as blue as the sky in all its depth, as blue as the back of the small and determined beetle who struggles to roll his enormous dung ball in his own breeding bid to enchant another small blue miracle. Part of their mating plumage is they get this beautiful sapphire ring around their eye, and I had not known that the inside tissue of their beaks turns blue as well.
Find more poetry about birds at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.